You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like you.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and if you're joining me today, I have to say thank you. So if you're listening, you've listened to probably more than 170 episodes of this show. You've probably heard me repeat many phrases, anecdotes, nonsense throughout this entire thing. But if you have been fortunate enough to be listening since the very earliest episodes, you would know that I really assembled this show with three people. I like to call us in my head the Easy Financing Crew. I think if we did have a WhatsApp group, that's what it should be called. There's the name of that just taken care of. But, you know, three of my dearest friends, exceptionally talented people, and just near and dear to my heart. And if you've listened to the show, you know how much they already mean to me, but I will introduce them as I have wanted to do with every single show. Right now around the grounds in my new studio, you've got Garth Franklin, who is an internet movie news trailblazer. And he's kind of the Ben Bradley of the movie news internet scene at the moment. He's the only one that still has integrity. Everyone else has been in some kind of sex scandal, as far as I'm concerned. If they've been working as long as Garth, they've been involved in a sex scandal.
How can I not be involved in a sex scandal? I'm actually disappointed.
They haven't been reported.
Ah, that's better. Yeah.
So on to the next one.
To
the next guest. The next guest is
Young. We could have more sex.
Someone you've heard at the beginning, the middle, and end of this entire story. He's been essential to it, and his just tenacity and niggling, his wonderful niggling, is a huge part of what led me down this garden path. And I love him to bits. If you like to listen to nonsense in movies, you need to listen to his other show, the Cinephiles podcast, with two inferior legs of the tripod, with Stu, the girthy, weight-bearing leg of that tripod.
There's a sex scandal in there.
So there's something in there.
Mediocre one. No, it's not going to get much.
Well, you can get it.
Take somebody say girthy. It is Stu Coote. Thank you, Stu, for being a part of the show. And finally, I think the most brazenly unique Australian film critic, who literally, when I read his work, not only is stellar, articulate, informed, and awesome, it has an air of, I don't give a fuck what you think. This is what I think. And I think that is far too rare in an industry that purports to like bring something to the art. And it's a pleasure to have him back in front of me because I haven't seen him in a little while, Mr. Luke Buckmaster. So welcome to 1-8 Minute.
Well, thank you, Blake. It's a pleasure to be here. And I remember actually a couple of years ago when you floated the idea of doing this podcast. There was Mojitos involved.
There was Hazley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was various different criticisms of the idea. Also, I believe that, you know, the words "you're a father," "you're a parent," "you have two children," "what are you thinking?" I think they were all thrown
your
at you.
Wife.
They were thrown
there
at
was
you.
There was talk of payment. That never played out.
No, that's right. But like a lot of the progressive big thinkers, you know, you dance to your own drumbeat, and here we are. How long later? A year? 2 years?
2 years.
2 years. There you go. 2 years later, and you've created a stunning success, Blake. You really have, and it's been a wonderful privilege to be part of the program, but also to listen to it and to watch it progress from strength to strength.
Thank you, man. It's been just
sensationally entertaining. But kudos to you.
Oh, thank you, buddy. That's really, really nice coming from you. So yeah, I just wanted to get us back together. I thought we would do an interesting format. I thought I would give these three gentlemen a chance to talk about a minute that they didn't get to talk about during the series. I'm just going to let them have carte blanche. Pick a minute. I'm looking across, directly diagonally across from me, and Stu is already knowing. He's like, what if we all pick the Ralph minute is what he's thinking right now. What if we all...
I was getting off the train yesterday and I thought of the minute I wanted. And I am still annoyed I didn't get to do it because I was watching it as I was walking up the stairs, which is a dangerous thing to do at the best of times.
You were watching the film as you were walking up the stairs?
Yeah, yeah.
On your phone? Or?
Yeah. With the headphones.
Because that's what Michael Mann wanted you to watch on your phone. Yeah.
Just as Dante's not intended.
Yeah. It was like when I watched Godfather 2 for the first time on an iPad.
While walking somewhere? Or?
No, I was seated. I was in an office. Well, but I was like, I thought, this is how Coppola wants me to see it. I think this is...
You're coming to the most serious bit, and Cheryl from accounting is there.
Sorry, pause. What was that? Sorry. Yeah. So I know my minute. It's not the Ralph minute because that's low hanging fruit. So,
okay.
Lucky Ralph. But
all right, guys. First up, Mr. Garth Franklin, can you tell us the minute that we're queuing up and why?
Well, it's the break-in scene. We'll play the minute. Can I talk about it?
Yeah, it's the 73rd minute. And you guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about
right
there. Walk! Now!
Come on!
There it is.
Mm. I love this minute because this is, of course, the point where the film becomes a film. It's like, they just kind of caught in there and it'd be like, bang, over, the whole movie ends. But with this... the previous heist with the break-in with the car and all that sort of stuff, that was just a smash and grab, and that could have been done by any sort of crew, whereas this thing is like, it's almost like an exquisite heist moment, where it's about the silence of the whole shot. There's no dialogue except for that one little, let's get out of here sort of thing. And the framing of those things with both the infrared De Niro in one shot and the outside of the building in the other, and what is essentially a simple mistake causes everything, the rest of the movie, to basically happen and all the events to cascade from here. But it's just beautifully framed. I love the way that this is specifically shot. That's my big thing about this.
And you still need to show them walking away from a job to show they do have the discipline to do that.
Yes.
To actually see it in
when
practice.
He's like right there with, you know, they've basically got hands on the cash.
But we are walking away. Yeah. Like that is the discipline. Yeah. It's funny that Chris actually goes, "No, I'm right almost there." And he's like, "No, we walk. Like, it's funny that he has to reiterate, like, "No, we're going." That even in because the adrenaline's going and he's We're so close.
Yeah, it's a nice little touch. And is that Captain Hydration? Isn't that?
Yeah, it's Captain Hydration.
Is it Jerry Ford's? Is it Jerry Ford's son?
Yeah. Gerald Ford. Yeah. President Gerald Ford's son.
Yep.
But what is what it could easily be, you know, a raccoon or something like that, just moving, making one tiny little noise. It's the kind of thing that most people would just dismiss.
Yeah. And the actual setting of it. And
does, walks away.
The settings of it is interesting to see what, like, it's a, in terms of the actual staging that anyone else would just see it, to shoot an industrial area like that.
Yeah.
Like, to what he does with the shadows.
Yeah.
The and shadows actually are having that as a place to hide.
Yes.
Is done so smartly. Mm. Just, to, what does it tell us about De Niro's character as well, that even though it's nighttime, he's still going to back himself back into the show. He could, like, and just chill out there.
Even though there's no one visibly around, no car noise, no nothing.
Yeah, and having human faces in front of a blank black background really does pronounce the emotion, the features, and it's got a slightly kind of chilling effect.
Oh, the whole thing with the infrared camera has the chilling effect where he's like, he doesn't move. The whole thing is the face is like, catches it and then just stays and just... Oh, I just love this.
I tweeted the other day, because at the time we were recording this, they recently released the Last Blood, the Rambo Last Blood trailer with Sylvester Stallone. And one of the things that I wrote, I was like, Rambo talks more in this trailer than he did in the whole of First Blood. Like, I what I love about this minute and this scene is that, and I love about Michael Mann movies, is there are so many opportunities for exposition, and they make he makes calculated choices to... just have people convey emotion, thoughts, you know, tense, otherwise fears, without any dialogue. And so for me, this is just, this is like pure visual storytelling.
It's, that's what cinema is.
That's exactly what cinema should be. Like, I think sometimes that old television adage or like, you know, serial, you know, TV, like Friends or a sitcom or something like that. Everything's about the exposition and the repartee. But this moment is about instinct and fear and something is wrong.
And just show, don't tell.
Yes.
Just people have the faith in your audience that they're gonna work it out.
Yeah.
Like, someone else would be dumb enough to go, "Did he hear us? I don't think he heard us. No, let's sit here. He didn't hear us." It's like, oh, just simple work.
And the music.
The music is so good. Just that one eerie tone, uninterrupted. That I love in this scene. I love Pacino's whip. Like, he whips his head around. Whips his head around, like, freaks out, and then whips it back, and the focus that he comes back with. And there's almost, I don't know, I want to say that there's a raised eyebrow, but I think I'm going to have to go back to the tape, because I know that sitting in front of Luke Buckmaster, he's not going to believe that there was a raised eyebrow. I mean, as contentious things like that wasn't smile, a smile.
Smilegate.
Smilegate. I mean,
if that episode happens, well, may or may not have been.
Well, you've got to call people to account.
Yeah.
You've got to be diligent here, and that's what.
That's what's underpinned this entire podcast.
That's what I thought.
Taking Michael Mann to task.
Yeah. And Blake Howard.
Yeah. Well, he's the vehicle we do.
But no, I think it's like, I'm actually gonna go back, because I wanna see it again, just to point out the second of
yeah, but also being a fantastic ad for L'Oreal with the hair whipping and the and like Val Kilmer's hair,
yeah. There's just this like sort of fraction of a second there where it's maybe 24, 23 seconds in, and for the most part you've been watching this intense gaze of Pacino right down the barrel, and it's so phenomenally framed that he's just staring right through you. It's not in your eyes, it's not awkward, it's not that weird. Sometimes there's a bit of a tension of breaking the fourth wall that it's awkward, but it's just perfectly staring through you, and you're in that mindset. And most of the time you're seeing De Niro there in I call it infrablue. Michael Mann doesn't have infrared, it's infrablue, because it's blue everything. But just this one little flash that you get of his eyes staring through, I think it has a deep relationship with you as he sort of glances past and he just walks. And it's a sublime scene. I love it. I love it to pieces. But yes, my friend who is an Australian federal police officer, who's been on the show, whose surname we redacted for his protection, said this is the moment he would have pinched him. and that's why there would be no movie if we stuck to the authenticity of the criminal experience. Would be, we'd pinch him right here as attempted breaking in, get him off the street and start working the next case.
So he doesn't have coffee with his criminal...
No,
he doesn't have a big chin wag and a... I'll get you and you'll get me. And
chasing each other around the block.
Yeah, you don't do that.
No, not quite yet. Not quite yet.
Damn reality.
It's a whole, but it is also the first scene in the film where it's an actual confrontation between the two, even though it doesn't actually happen in terms of physical reality.
73
it's,
minutes.
It's all through the language of the media, but it's the first time.
It's tremendous.
And it's not that long after the, where they say it's the criminal convention, when they're on the rooftop.
No.
It's not that long. No. Like, it shows how well they got off everyone, got their, got all the comms, got all the surveillance devices in. Yeah, they reeled them in very quickly once they got the first break.
And it does a nice callback to the whole line of the, one of the lines that we did together, which is, are there any high-end burglaries that have mystified us? And this is precisely one of those things that's a high-end burglary that would have mystified them had they not been looking for a crew like this.
But also, it's like a nice counterpoint because you have the scene afterward, the docks is shortly after this one, isn't the point? Yeah, where you have,
not far away.
They've swapped positions where De Niro is the one staking him out, and unlike, you know, Pacino, he doesn't fail at his job.
Well, he does exactly what he wants.
He was asked that to do, yeah.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, there we go. That was a nice short and sharp digression into a wonderful minute. Now, Stu, your minute, the minute in question that you're desperate to talk about.
Yeah, meeting Torino and his brother in the club.
We're going to go back in time. Take a listen.
We even get into that. There's this crew ripping rides all along the beach areas, all right? Now, the back of a trim shop on Irvine, if somebody was to pay a little visit this weekend, they might find two turbos in a 911 slope.
You're looking to rid yourself of your competition.
Hey, I'm a good citizen.
I'm Donald Duck. So you got something to tell me or what?
Check this out, cuz. How do I know if I tell you what you need to know, you're gonna do what the fuck I need to get done?
Richard, Manhattan is straight up, man. We do business all the time. I ain't your cuz, you rat motherfucker. And you know, cause I say so. After I hear what the fuck you gotta tell me.
Look here, man. You understand what I'm saying? I'd get killed for telling you this shit.
Killed walking your doggy.
All right. This cat I was locked up with in Folsom. Did a couple, 2-3 years. He got out, I ran into him.
And so?
He's a big fiend for action. Now, if he'd have said nothing, I'd have thought nothing. But he goes on and on, running down to me how he ain't been doing nothing, and nothing's been going on, and all this other bullshit. So right then and there, I know this cat's got something going down.
Pretty fucking great. Albert, what's wrong with you? You drag me here, waste my time like this. You saw a guy on the street who's an ex-con.
That's right.
Well, I am over fucking well. What do you want for that, a junior G-man badge?
Look here, man, you gonna make the call on them Porsches or what?
Is you kidding me?
All right, we broke the discipline.
We had to.
We just had to run 2 minutes of that scene. It is such a glorious scene.
The reason I love this is
47th, 48th minute. It's wonderful.
For my own podcast recently, I've had to revisit Basic Instinct and The Bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
Two great episodes.
Yeah, doesn't sound like a chore.
No, but I'm talking to Luke like he doesn't know, like he hasn't listened to them already. First download was Mr. Buckmaster. Yeah. But anyway, just the 90s clubs.
Mm. Like, oh, 90s clubs are good. Yeah. In the both of those.
Playing, they got that, but it's always the eclectic, like there's like people either in leather stuff, there's people in grunge.
Yeah.
Especially the Basic Instinct one.
Which has all the purple lighting, all the flashing.
Oh, the unisex toilet really a coke den, which is not very sanitary. It's but no, this
most of the toilets are coke dens in the right or wrong.
Look, I don't want to generalize.
And to be fair,
a lot of them are.
To be fair, 90s movies, nightclubs are not sanitary. Period.
It's so good. But to go into
this is evidence of Australia lagging, because I'm sure I went in the early 2010s, and there was still unisex coke den nightclub.
But I love that you go to this club and it's House of Pain playing, and you're like, that seems a bit at odds with what this place is sort of going for at the bottom of a Chinese restaurant downstairs with metal detectors. But I love just Albert, like, watching exactly where the conversation's going, and he's waiting for his brother to actually say something relevant, like, going, I know Hannah, and I've dragged him down here at 3 o'clock in the morning. I love when he's just looking at him like, please say something good.
My favorite reaction, one of my favorite reactions in the whole movie of Hannah, looking at him, looking at Richard, so Tone Loke, looking at him like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Then pivoting to Albert, Albert is nodding it's the greatest idea he's ever heard or the greatest piece of information. And then he looks back and goes, like, instantaneously realizes the tact he's going to take with it. Pretty fucking great. Albert, what is wrong with you?
And not to win, like, you know, there's the look in Avengers Endgame when Thor's telling his depressed story and Ant-Man's doing that sort of smile. Like, Paul Rudd does that look where he's smiling and along with the story, like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
And Albert does it so well. And I love how well Pacino shuts him down.
Oh,
and,
it's beautiful.
And you get shot walking your doggy.
Al Pacino has an art in shutting people down.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's got this wonderful ability, as we've seen in this scene, of not so much listening to somebody as not tolerating what they're saying and waiting. Yeah. You know, there's the whole kind of like idea that some, you know, some people are just, they're listening and other people are waiting for their turn to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure exactly where Al Pacino falls.
Yeah.
I think there's a large part he's waiting for his turn to speak.
Yeah.
But he also hears and he listens.
Can I read the three of you one of my favourite bits of correspondence that I've almost ever received on this show? One of the great things is that people have been involved and they're sending through stuff. I got this note and it says, subject, I'm terrified. Message, I recently got a dog for my young children and I've been tasked with walking the dog. My question to you is, can you really get shot while walking your doggy? That is the whole message. That is a One Heat Minute fan. That is a diehard fan of this movie. And I responded back and said, that might be the funniest email I think I've ever received. And since then, I've been in touch with that person.
Their name has obviously been redacted also.
No. I don't know if it's their real name. And I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right. But it's like Shimon or Shimon or something like that. But holy shit, Shimon is Shimon. However you pronounce it.
If you're still with us,
get the dog, walk it. And be proud of the dog. It'll give you a lot of satisfaction.
Yes. And
you're a dog owner. I'm a
dog lover.
Dog lover.
I'm a dog lover.
Yeah, but you've never experienced any drive-by...
Drive-by shooting. Shootings on my dog.
No. Or on yourself for that. You seem intact.
No. But whenever I...
No hairy moments?
So my dog is a Jack Russell, but she's very sort of cute and elegant looking Jack Russell too. So basically, if I go to the supermarket, I don't want to tie her up outside. I'm just too paranoid that someone's going to steal it.
Yeah.
My beloved dog. Bessie. Bessie. Thank you, Stu. So yeah, my advice to, I was going to say to your caller, but this is actually not a live radio program.
No.
But my advice to your email there is that, you know, get the dog and
you bring me out here. Yeah. Waste my time like this for no call-in podcast.
Down because the joy it will give you is, you know, profound.
Yes.
Alternatively, as someone, an ex-Doberman owner, I get a big dog. No one was trying to shoot you.
Yes, and if we'd learn anything from John Wick 3, Parabellum, just get two Belgian Malinois.
Really angry dogs.
We will throw people around like ragdolls.
Did Tone Loke do anything else? Because he's pretty good in this. Like,
oh, you mean acting-wise?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think he holds his own.
Yeah. It's a wonderful kind of voice.
Yeah.
His voice is just...
Yeah. But he had to do...
It's like someone's been licking cigarettes for about 30 years.
Of the two, I prefer him to Henry Rollins in this. Henry Rollins had more to do.
Yeah, Henry Rollins definitely has more to do. Yeah. Tone Loke has to come in for like a minute.
And he nails it with what
hits the magic out. I'm just vamping for me while I do love that Tone Loke.
I do love the look when like Hannah just leans back. It's just like, wow, like I'm out fucking stand.
But you had to hold your own against Al Pacino, wouldn't it?
And
I do wonder what, like, when they call cut. And, you know, the actors reset and reality kicks back in and we talk to each other like we're not in a movie set and whatnot. What Al Pacino would be like. But, you know, I actually have no idea. I haven't seen any... behind the scenes footage or anything like that.
There's a wonderful interview, and I can't remember the publication, but I definitely talked to Katie Walsh about it, and I think I talked to Fran Hoffner about it around Henry Rollins did an interview about his time on set and saying that particularly the scene where Pacino has to throw Hugh Benny through the window, and he had to be Henry Rollins had to be tied up for a long time. They were doing multiple scenes with him handcuffed to like a chair or something like that on the balcony. And in all the cuts, because it just was going on and it was quite a long night, he said Pacino was sitting next to him on the floor, like just hanging out, like talking to him, and they were having like a great chat, and they were really interested in one another, and they were just sort of, you know, shooting the shit and having a whole heap of fun. And then like they'd get up and do the intense scene, and then Pacino would be back down sitting next to him, you know, rubbing shoulders. So like that's the kind of guy that he feels like, very natural, gregarious, fun, takes his process seriously, but also doesn't, unlike his contemporary in this movie, you know, he's his counterpoint in De Niro, who's much more focused and sort of needs to be maintaining character and mood and tension to sort of keep on point with his delivery. Pacino seems like a bit more of a classically theatrical actor who can go in and then jump out and go in and do out.
But also, I don't think we get those appreciations for those nights that are like, or the days like, 16-hour day.
Oh my god!
To do the various things you got to do. So there'd be so much downtime.
Or so much waiting around for things to get set up for different shots. That's always the way of film production.
If you've ever worked in one of those industries like mine, is like there's so much downtime and can be waiting, like can be hours upon hours, and you're just sitting there shooting the shit. I can imagine it'd be a pleasure to be working with someone who was
interesting to talk to,
or able to step back from it, as opposed to like, you know. Being a Daniel Day-Lewis who, like, with someone that's so intense so all the time. Kind of thing, like, you'd be like, oh, mate, do you want a coffee?
Method actors would be really annoying to work with, wouldn't they?
Well, I'm a method podcaster.
What is a method podcaster? Does that mean you talk?
Only if there's a microphone there.
What do you mean?
You transfer it across to you.
So well, I can't podcast any other way.
But you can talk any other way.
Yeah.
So there's no microphone, you still talk.
Yeah. But just when I'm podcasting, there needs to be a microphone there to record it.
It doesn't mean he...
That's just my style.
Yeah, no, look, it's that's pretty
how
controversial.
It's how pretty, I was... It's pretty wild. It's a newer school.
You're blowing my
mind. The year of Tone Loke was 93. He did Posse and then Poetic Justice and then Surf Ninjas of the South China Sea.
And you get us in here talking heat.
AKA Surf Ninjas. AKA Surf Ninjas for folks in Australia. He was then...
Ace Ventura,
Pet Detective, Blank Check, and then later on he did a couple of episodes of News Radio Heat, and then Spy Hard was the last big one, and there's lots of things that just like fell off the map there. One of his most recent acting credits in something called Not Cool was Pedestrian Number 2.
Oh.
So
classic of the genre.
Yeah. So, there we go. Mr. Buckmaster.
Pedestrian Number 2 is in the sequel?
No, or... Pedestrian Number 2 is his role.
In what film?
What was it called?
Let's have a look at the records.
Yep.
Not cool, Pedestrian Number 2. Okay, yep. No.
We've got that clarified.
Not cool.
Appreciate that.
I got a feeling it wasn't a... There weren't many lines.
A group of modern day...
Except the ones he was crossing.
That's true. Yeah.
Wow, it has a score of 1 on Metacritic. Reviews.
That's actually pretty... That's an achievement.
How many reviews?
4.
Four. That's a small sample.
Small audience, 5,000. 5,000 ratings, 4.5 out of 10 on IMDb, which like is a very generous audience raters. But
people are usually got their finger on the pulse.
No, they don't.
As I remind everyone, Aladdin made $200 million last weekend.
Yes. I'm waiting to see how much Luke is going to say, and no, he didn't even...
Not taking that bait.
Didn't take the bait.
No, we're in that same boat together.
I know, I've read.
We're on the magic carpet ride. Yeah. We won off.
Yeah, we've had enough. We're taking down the mouse house.
Yeah.
So, no, I do love this scene. This is just... there's something about Hannah. He's on fire.
Yeah, he's on fire in this minute.
And again, we see the physical dominance of, like, we've seen him talk down to people throughout all this when he's got the power, and for him to actually put the hand over when he's calling him like a rat.
He doesn't care.
Yeah. He's treating them like shit.
Yeah.
And Albert knows. Albert knows what he's capable of.
Albert's already had his, yeah. his breakfast shaken yeah. to the ground this morning. So he's ready to rock and roll. Mr. Buckmaster, last but most certainly not least.
Yes. Well, so in terms of the minute to rewatch, so when you think about Heat and you consider the most memorable scenes, there are some scenes that jump out in the memory more than most. And if you're particularly given the task of picking a minute, you might be accused of being cliche or predictable or whatnot with your scene selection. So I just want to put that as a context around this. However. As someone who is occasionally called a cynical person, and when I'm called a cynical person, obviously my response would be, "You're wrong," and that reflects a bad thing about humankind that you would even say that.
You now have the catchphrase you can say. I reject your hypothesis.
I reject the hypothesis. Yeah. Your hypothesis.
Yes.
I fucking love. Though. Can I say?
Hypothesis is a bit.
Can I just say? Sort of I love that as a response. I don't think that's a bad response. If someone asks you a question that you know is a clickbait, bullshit. Trap question,
yeah,
and you don't agree with what they're saying, it is actually quite an elegant way to dance out of it. Obviously,
it's Tarantino that you're referencing.
Yeah.
But it needs a second act. Like in that press conference for Once Upon a Time.
Well, he's going to, because he's going to Margot film it Robbie in 70 mil, and it's going to take, it'll be the roadshow version.
Margot Robbie did the talking, and you can see the way she was saying, she's like, oh, I'm just going to do the talking here, and QT is going to be fuming on the side.
Or are you saying he should have stepped in and said, I just stop talking, don't acknowledge
it. It just needs a second act, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the task of choosing the minute, having been occasionally described as a single person, I'm also very nostalgic. And I remember a time not so long ago where we were all together talking about a minute. And I know that the way you said it was, I think you said the minute that you're desperate to talk about. I think that's about how you said it.
Yeah.
So that's fine. So the minute I am desperate to relive the wonderful time that we all shared together talking at Sydney Film Festival, we looked at the diner scene. And of course it is... the cliche scene, if you want to call it that, or the predictable scene, but it also speaks to the strengths of a film, which is this sprawling concrete playground of a crime movie, where most people or many people will come out of that experience, and what will they remember? They'll remember two people, as in terms of the potent scenes, big scenes. They'll remember two people sitting down, having a coffee, and talking. And to be able to construct such a massive dramatic experience around such a prosaic moment, I just think speaks to the film's strengths. So I understand it's a predictable or cliche choice, but I couldn't resist, gentlemen. I couldn't.
I love it. Let's play the whole fucking scene.
And many times our conversation here, because we're always across the table from these two,
mm-hmm.
I just don't know if we're De Niro or Pacino.
Are, yeah, we are always.
They're always pitted against each other.
Yeah, like, I think we're Pacino together.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they're De Niro.
Yeah.
Garth looks pretty shocked.
Yeah.
He's doing his hair. Also.
Yeah, they're the quiet, they're the silent types, and we're the gregarious sort of like
yes,
emotional.
Right. Yeah. We'll listen and tolerate you for a little bit.
Yeah. But then
when given a moment to speak. Boom. Yeah.
And then both of you. Blake, what's wrong with you? Here we go, let's watch this scene together. This is actually a perfect way to almost wrap up this entire series, to watch the scene of the film with my legends, my crew. Here we go.
McNeil is tough, as they say. You're looking to become a penologist? You're looking to go back? You know, I chase down some crews, guys just looking to fuck up, get busted back. And you?
You must have worked some dipshit crews.
I worked all kinds.
You see me doing thrill-seeker liquor store holdups with a Born to Lose tattoo on my chest?
No, I do not.
Right. I am never going back.
Then don't take down scores.
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me.
So you never wanted a regular type life?
The fuck is that? Barbecues and ball games? Yeah. This regular type life, that your life? My life? No, my life. No, my life's a disaster, so. I got a stepdaughter so fucked up because her real father's this large type asshole. I got a wife. We're passing each other on the downslope of a marriage, my third. Because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block. That's my life. Guy told me one time, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around a corner. Now, if you're on me and you gotta move when I move, how do you expect to keep a marriage?
Well, that's an interesting point. What are you, a monk?
I have a woman.
What do you tell her?
I tell her I'm a salesman.
So then if you spot me coming around that corner, you're just gonna walk out on this woman? Not say goodbye?
That's the discipline.
That's pretty vacant. No?
Yeah, it is what it is. It's that or we both better go do something else, pal.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Neither do I.
I don't much want to either.
Neither do I.
You know, I have this recurring dream. I'm sitting at this big banquet table, and all the victims of all the murders I ever worked are sitting at this table, and they're staring at me with these black eyeballs because they got eight ball hemorrhages from the head wounds. And there they are, these big balloon people, because I found them 2 weeks after they'd been under the bed. The neighbors reported the smell. And there they are, all of them just sitting there.
What do they say?
Nothing.
No talk?
None. Just, they don't have anything to say. See, we just look at each other. They look at me, and that's it. That's the dream.
I have one where I'm drowning, and I gotta wake myself up and stop breathing or I'll die in my sleep.
You know what that's about?
Yeah, having enough time.
Enough time to do what you want to do?
That's right.
You're doing it now.
Not yet.
You know, we're sitting here. You and I are like a couple of regular fellas. You do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in? Then I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get my way. We've been face to face, yeah. But I will not hesitate. Not for a second.
Maybe that's the way it'll be. Or, who knows?
Well, maybe we'll never see each other again.
just breaking fucking rules in the end of this podcast.
It's a terrible it's a terrible sort of feeling to end the first date with someone saying, maybe we'll never see each other again. It's like, oh, I thought I had a connection. I thought we had a connection. And then
we shared some dreams.
Threatening to kill you with your words. Yeah. Saying, I'm never seeing you again. But
then again, brother, you are going down is a good line on a date.
Yeah. No, it's the centerpiece scene, really, isn't it? Yeah. And it even explains the title. And it's funny, when I remember that scene and when it kind of plays over in my mind, I recall those guys talking to each other and no one else being around them. I just recall this empty, blank space and it's just Pacino and De Niro. But then, of course, when you watch the scene, it's a busy, crowded...
Very quiet diner.
Very... Well, it's actually quite crowded.
Yeah, it's quiet.
Deliberately. At the start of the scene, it sort of seems louder, and I think it's cleverly
masked.
Yeah. The noise of the surroundings becomes a little bit more diluted and quietened.
It's a classic nightclub trick where they film a lot of movie scenes in nightclubs where you hear a conversation between two people. They'll always lower the volume of the general sort of outside things, and so you have a lot of people, extras, dancing to nothing
in the background
to get the effect.
Yeah, but then when they walk into the club, there's the establishing moment where it's louder, and absolutely.
And I know we just had it with the Game of Thrones season 8 where everyone's go to is like, oh, the writing's terrible, the writing, it's all like, but then when you see how well that script is written. I know the dream stuff was a bit of improv from...
Completely improv.
Between the two of them.
Completely improv. The dream sequences were not in the original script.
But leading...
Not even in the shooting draft. The third shooting draft in March of 95.
Which is amazing.
Amazing, yeah. Wow.
It was completely organically created by both these guys.
But leading up to that, the sort of the tension and then the little break where they just become... And so it's led by Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just the way it's sort of the little push-pull of the writing. And then when he finally sort of, when they sort of both calm down, and that's written into it so well. And I just, it is exceptionally put together. I think it's funny when it started, the actual diner looks probably nicer than it is. Like the people in the back are all like in white shirts and ties. It looks like a trendy restaurant.
Yeah.
But then there's a bottle of ketchup on the table, and I'm always like, oh, this is, it feels weird. It feels like it's, they're spending too much money on too many staff and their uniforms, or they're just a rinky-dink diner. It's one thing.
I think in America, you do expect the ketchup on the table.
Some condiments.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Your ketchup and maybe your mustard.
Yeah.
But they could have taken it out of the bottle and put it in a nice glass container or something.
Or a squeezy bottle.
Are you saying they should have had a squeezy bottle or a non-squeezy bottle?
I'm not even sure. I just find it weird that they're too well dressed for having a bottle of sauce on the table.
So you feel that the ketchup bottle sort of takes away from the integrity of their moment, almost.
I just don't find this diner's
being
too
honest.
There's
no dignity with ketchup.
Yeah.
You're saying it's dishonest to have ketchup on the table at a
dinner. No, I'm just saying that this...
Undignified. I think you're saying something.
Yeah, it's like, well, they
it's
either...
It's disingenuous ketchup.
Well, no, it's a... I don't know if the place is either not being honest about what their actual calibre they're at.
We don't know what the menu is. So
no, but I just look at the bar staff in the back, they're all like, and they're serving wine glasses, and then you've like.
But if it's in a in a corporate environment, though, plenty of people will sneak down to like a meat eatery, sort of like meat and potatoes coffee shop that has great diner food, and they're all looking to the nines because they're dressed in corporate attire. So maybe it's just one.
No, the staff are dressed impeccably.
It also comes down to what dishes you would apply to the ketchup. So, chips, obviously.
Yeah. Yes.
But what else?
Exactly. There's not too many things that you'll put a splash of sauce on.
So, you would want a chip-heavy menu.
Exactly.
If it doesn't have a lot of fries everywhere, I don't want
to
have
that. In a place like this, I just expect it to be in a little side dish when it comes out with the chips.
And where you're saying this place, it's more like your T-bone steak.
Maybe, yeah. Who knows? Like,
you wouldn't
these uncouth bastards are putting places, ketchup on steak.
You go to some American outlets, like, say, Johnny Rockets, for example, which is just the old 50s burgers. And yet they're all impeccably dressed in, like, crisp white shirts and white hats and all this sort of stuff. It could be a themed restaurant for all.
We've got to get to the bottom of this. We're not moving. We're not leaving here tonight. until we get to the bottom of this. No, but I do. I love that look, the one that Pacino, when he first does that cheeky smile, and it cuts to him, and that's the one that sort of breaks De Niro as well.
Yeah. But it's also...
It does that look back smirk sort of thing.
It comes back off of an extremely candid moment. He's like, I'm on the downside of marriage, my third.
Mm. Yeah, but that's...
Because I chase guys around your life. That's my life. Yeah. And then he goes, and just smiles at him.
But that was the beautiful thing with that moment, was because earlier in the thing, maybe a few minutes before, De Niro gets the whole psychological profile, essentially, of Pacino's character.
Yeah.
And it feels like he has an advantage. And then Pacino just says, yeah, that's exactly what my life is.
That's exactly what my life is. Mm. The fuck is that? Barbecues and bowl games.
It's an interesting thing as well with, if you're remembering back to Unbreakable, when they do the date night, there's that cool shot. There's the establishing shot. They're in the bar. They're sitting at the bar. And the establishing shot is like from the other, and it really just edges in.
Yeah.
This starts quite wide.
Mm.
And then by the end, we are just there. And I like that. That's when the noise of the diner is sort of dulled.
Yeah.
And it is, and it really feels like we are. And I like how Pacino's always closing the space. Yeah. But De Niro never mirrors him to come in. Because naturally, in a conversation, you expect to draw someone in, and De Niro's like, I'm not playing this game.
No, De Niro doesn't play it, but he definitely sits back. He sits into it and he straightens his posture and he turns his head.
Yeah.
But Pacino's got the more dynamic. The dynamic...
He's trying to chip away at him to like...
Mm. Yeah.
And he's not letting him in, even when they swap the personal stories, he's not really...
Just
in.
My favorite... But he does relax a little.
Yeah.
He said
yeah.
in the body language.
My favorite... I read about it in... There's a wonderful... Sydney-based university performance theorist named George Kavaris, who he talked about punctuative gestures. So using facial expressions and gestures to sort of punctuate different sentences. And I heard the phrase a long time ago, and it's a bit of a weird phrase, and you don't hear it a lot. But the sort of quintessential punctuative gesture for me is like, so when you spot me coming around that corner, boom, and he just has this.
Mm.
His chin moves is like, it's like the most perfect ellipsis to a sentence because it literally is. It manufactures a pause in the conversation and it's a pause in the dialogue. And it just, I think it, you know, when I watch this scene, and I cannot even fathom how many fucking times I've watched this scene. But when I watch this scene and I watch them together, I'm like, there are maneuvers and things that these guys are doing with instinct and effortlessness and just like, and because they're in some kind of flow state that other actors, I don't ever like. It's when I watch these guys, I imagine there's one time where I rolled with my black belt, what used to be my black belt professor at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Professor Fabio. And one time he was rolling with me and he knew that I was getting better. So one time he grabbed me and he goes, okay, Blake, we're going to do the countdown until I tap you out. Okay. And I'm like, okay, we hadn't even touched each other at this point. We clap hands and he goes, 10, 9, 8, 7. And I'm trying to like just get away from him. And he's like, 6, 5, we finally tussle, 4, 3, 2, and as predicted, I'm tapped out. And I think that these guys are on that level.
Do you think it's good luck or good management sometimes?
For these two guys? Absolutely both.
Like, do you think it's like that do we pour so much importance into every wince and every half look, or is it this, if you put anything under the microscope for long enough, it'll start to look like...
You could. I think that's the mastery of this movie. Like, now, this is the second time, maybe third time that we're, you know, second time certainly that we've tussled with one of the minutes of this. It's definitely... You know, many times that I've tussled with this particular scene, I actually genuinely think there are plenty of scenes that you can relive. And I love what Luke was talking about, taking a prosaic activity and elevating it to the centerpiece of a massive drama. Yeah. There are plenty of movies that do it. I just genuinely don't think that I think one of its formal choices, like giving a platform for great actors to just act in a space that really highlights every maneuver, every gesture, everything they're doing. Cause a lot of it's framing, you know, like you said, the frame sort of in this glacial pace sort of closes in. And by the end of it, you are like, you know, in a one shot earlier, I think what they famously call like a Montana, which is like a second button shot, at your,
at your chest height and above your head is kind of where it starts, and it kind of glacially goes in a, like, in an inexplicable way. I think it's that formal choice. I think it's the takes. You know, Michael Mann famously talks about take 11, so building them into a rhythm.
This was take 11.
Take 11, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. We don't know. I wonder how much... Is that in, if it's that take in its entirety, or if this is a Frankenstein?
No, he says it's mostly take 11.
Okay,
he says it's mostly take 11 from his memory. Actually, it's one of the funny things if you research Heat. This there's a Heat trailer where I think it's like the second or third trailer. There's a De Niro line delivery from an alternate take of this, and it's really pronounced for a psychopath like myself who's done this exercise, because I'm like, oh, that's not that take, it's another take.
Because I haven't watched it in a long time, but I almost, and I might go home and just bring the scene up tonight. I haven't watched the conversation Hunger in a long time.
Oh, Hunger's a,
like, because that's showier though. And to start with, they're a bit showier before they settle into getting into it, whereas this is not showy at all. This is really restrained.
That's also a much longer scene, though.
Yeah, it's like 25 minutes. Yeah.
Hunger's...
But they toy with each other a bit more before.
Yeah. And they're setting the mood, like the cigarette smoke and the light, the blinding glare coming into that room, that space that they're in the prison also, sets a mood. But yeah, like, it's a very... I think it's form, I think it's performance, I think it's flow, and one of the things that... and this is, you know, when, Stu, you just brought up a good point, it's like, sometimes you read into it because you're scrutinizing something to death. And I think that one of the things that they were talking about with Diane Venora when she was being Q&A'd at the famous Academy Awards screening that had, you know, I think for the 20th anniversary, for the 4K release. They were talking about Diane Venora about, you know, what it was like, how she fashioned a character. And she's very much a theatrical performer too. So she was like, it was on the page. Like, that's the thing about this script. So much of it was already there that what we were able to elevate and do, it wasn't like I was trying to rewrite the script or redo the lines or readjust. It was like the script was excellent. I got to go and deliver great dialogue. And then because I was delivering great dialogue effortlessly, I then can elevate my game because I'm not lumbering along with shit that is not bouncing off of the page or bouncing off of the people that I'm working with. It's like, I'm just jiving. And there are great people across from me, and there's great chemistry. And I think about it still, you know, in a thesis that I wrote on this, I spent a lot of time analyzing every part of this scene. But I even remember being in awe of Nick James, who did, I think, the 95th minute with me, who wrote the actual BFI, Sight and Sound BFI. He's the editor of Sight and Sound, Nick James. And he said, I did an exercise where I literally wrote every gesture. And he's like, he was right, and he reads it out on the podcast. If you ever get a chance to listen, it's back in episode 95. And it was just so amazing. Like, he's like, glance left, you know, glance right. Like, he was like literally going through every, you know, pursed lip, everything. And it's like, when you actually map it out, you're like, no, they're just doing way more than normal people do in a scene, because they're getting an opportunity to tussle with, like, their greatest contemporary. They're just trying to exercise every part of their craft because they've got someone who's bouncing off of them with energy across from them that's giving them something else that's just not, just doesn't happen.
Is it your favourite scene of the pill, would you say?
No.
Where's your favourite?
My favourite's the final scene.
That, yeah.
My favourite is absolutely the final scene. Mm-hmm. I think it has, we were talking about Tarantino before, and one way that Tarantino, like, you know, sometimes people say, like, a great word in a descriptor of a film, and you just sort of, like, it elevates that word and that concept for you. And I think he talked about David Michaud's The Rover, and talked about it as sort of an elemental neo-Western sci-fi thing. Like, you know, you look at a Mad Max, and we're talking to Mr. Mad Max across the table from you right now. You're talking about those...
he's talking to me.
Mr. Buckmaster. But you talk about those elemental things that happen. And I think that what this movie does is, you know, we just elevated this scene because it's elevating, you know, something prosaic. And that is taking that old white hat, black hat, you know, concept, and it essentially is what retrofits the entire movie to that moment. But I think it also just does so much to
infuse everything that we've seen for like 163 minutes into the power of that scene. So every gesture, every moment, every interaction, it is all just carrying this collective weight of the movie, and I just adore it. I adore it for its vision, for its silence, for its lack of dialogue, for just its resonance, and for things like the choices that the actors get to make, the score. Mm-hmm. And it moves me, it floors me. And I've been really lucky because not only this entire process, this show, I thought that the final minute of the movie, pre-credits, which if you're listening to this episode right now, you've heard is a 4 or maybe 5... maybe 5-part unpacking and examination of a single minute with 4 or maybe 5 guests. Maybe I 5.
I'm so confused.
because he's guests that we talked about that may or may not have appeared.
Or may not have appeared. Yes. So let's talk about the 165th minute. I'll just read you the sequence. So if you guys are now listening to the very first episode, you're going to feel lost because we've broken all the rules.
Imagine if this was your first, like you're coming in about a podcast that's breaking down minute by minute and you jump in the credits.
Jumping at this point, you're fucked.
What were you thinking? Anyone who's listening to that, is that what you did?
Well, last time I was on with Garth, we just challenged people to stop listening.
Yeah.
If that is them.
That's true.
Do we challenge them to stop listening again?
Well, we're about 40 minutes in. They got the right to stay.
It's like people who jump to the end of a book. It's like, what the hell are you doing?
Do you earn the right to keep listening?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're still 40 minutes
in. How dare you?
Yeah, no, that's
reasonable. So literally from the airport, we've got a great New York Times critic in Cameron Austin Collins, K. Austin Collins, if you guys know him. Andy Hazel, who's a writer for The Monthly in Oz and does a really terrific podcast called Cultural Capital, and also works alongside with the Melbourne International Film Festival. Reid Coleman, the author of the upcoming Heat prequel novel, who you would have heard some amazing stuff from. And I can tell you right now, off air, he told me way more than you guys heard. So Walter Chaw then comes on for a minute 163, who I think is arguably one of the greatest film critics alive. He's just absolutely stellar, and I'm so grateful for his participation. One of the greatest Australian film critics working today, and Uber Heat fan Craig Matheson, comes on for minute 164, if you've heard that. But so I was going through almost sequentially getting these lovely guests, and Travis Woods, who I deeply admire, I think is probably one of the emerging up-and-coming voices of especially long-form criticism, writing a lot for Cinephilia and Beyond, and particularly Bright Wall Dark Room, doing some amazing pieces. His most recent one is a Sorcerer piece, which I definitely highly recommend.
That's due a rewatch.
Absolutely.
It's great film.
He holds up so well. His previous writing was on Inherent Vice, and it's just stunning, beautiful 5,000-word gush fest, was great. And so when Travis and I approached that 165th minute, we got to it, we watched it, and it was sort of happening in sequence, and it fucking destroyed me. Like, I was just like, I almost couldn't talk. And Travis fortunately picked up the ball. But in the next episode, which is the final pre-credits minute with our 4, maybe 5 guests, 4, maybe 5 guests, I unpacked the exact previous minute, and like I'm looking around the table, and some of these guys know who the guests are and some of them don't. I decided to get a creator, I decided to get a critic, I decided to get a fan, I decided to get a friend, and maybe a fifth special guest on top of that to unpack the minute. So I feel almost like I got a chance to nearly lose my complete composure in the process of this show, and then also overcome that as part of this process. So if you guys are listening, you know that the creator is Phil Hay, co-writer of The Destroyer, partner of Karen Kusama, co-writer of a movie that I think is deeply underrated, R.I.P.D., The Invitation, and he came on the show. Phil did something for me. He told one of his friends about the show. His friend Christopher Nolan.
Heard of him.
Apparently. Name rings a bell.
Yeah. Didn't he have something to do with Aquaman?
Yeah. His brother did Westworld.
That's Jonathan Nolan's brother.
Yeah.
He must be one of those, like, you know, minor brothers, like Luke Hemsworth. You know?
He thinks the show's a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, so that was nice. Yeah. Chris Tapley. Christopher Tapley, who's one of the best awards pundits working for about the last 18 years for Variety, who is now, we got to be an exclusive, he's a recovering journalist. He's quit Variety. Mm. He's now moved on to filmmaking himself.
Good for him.
Had lovely things to say about you, Mr. Franklin.
Oh, he's a great guy.
He's absolutely wonderful. I had John Glynn, who's been a tremendous supporter and fan of One Hit Minute this entire way through, has been sending emails every week and has just been amazing. And now we're in constant text contact. And I love you, John. Thank you for being a part of the show. And then, look, I had to bookend the show with one of the Pelicans sitting across from me. No, it's not Mr. Luke Buckmaster. I also had...
this time.
I had Stu Coote come on because I felt like that it was fitting that at the end of the show, you would hear the guy who helped me start it. And so Stu got to come on. We had a really tremendous time talking.
And the only thing we missed out was actually our callback back to the statue of the third minute.
Yeah.
We didn't really bring that up.
We didn't bring it up.
Could listen to you guys just read the dictionary. Presumably there'd be some argument about which word and you'd alternate, which that would be wonderful. But I could listen to you guys read the dictionary, read the Bible, read the encyclopedia.
In the beginning.
Is that really the first word? Is it the first word?
I think it's a galaxy far, far away. long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
It says Genesis in big yellow.
And maybe, just maybe, before this episode, and I kind of wished that maybe that special fifth guest had happened so that we could be reacting to it. Maybe I'll put an addendum. If you're listening to this right now, there's four guests, and the show ends.
Yep.
There's been four guests in the final minute. And if not, when I do the little close here, there'll be a dot, dot, dot. There'll be a slight ellipses, a pause, and then I'll just be recording on an iPhone with much worse quality at the Sydney Film Festival with these three guys, probably with a few drinks under our belts, and you guys will know that this has happened. There's a fifth guest. Who would you think the fifth guest should be to close out the film?
Oh, well, you're looking at me.
I'm looking at Luke Buckminster.
Well, a clone of yourself would be great. Yeah. If I could listen to you talking, Blake, for hours and hours and days and days, I don't want to cut you out, Stu.
No, so, but it'd be an odd use of the technology. finally get to cloning, and they go, "What's the first use?" So we gotta going to harvest the organs? Are we going to do stuff? Are we going to
podcast?
And not just a podcast. He's going to be a guest for the final episode on his podcast.
Look, it's crazy enough to work.
And you go, "Thanks for coming on, mate." What do you mean? You came on my show. No. Wait a minute.
Which one was first?
I've got as much right to Paul Jennings' novel
I read a long time ago.
Sounds like a razor in the worst way possible with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mine would be your wife.
Oh.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the classy
answer. We are hanging out for that.
Look, I would just say this episode, if you're listening, is officially the 167th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 Crime Opus, but it's not. It was going to be credits, but this is kind of...
Yeah.
This is these guys back together.
It's a stocking filler.
This is a stocking filler. So right now there may be...
Are we stocking filler?
Aren't we?
After all these years, from a stocking filler.
A stocking filler is the good stuff.
But why?
Depends what kind of filler, then, I guess.
Why call it filler? Not some sort of long.
Well, little surprises. We're surprises in the I don't think we're the main present.
Oh, you're saying so we're not like you know, cotton fluff, whatever.
No, like the stocking filler, like at Christmas, you just have a little stocking. Okay, we're not the main present, which is I think we're not a PlayStation. No, but we might be like a little.
You might be Red Dead Redemption.
Use the word filler. It sounds.
I can live with that. Yeah.
I pronounce the word filler right.
Stuffer? Stocking stuffer?
Doesn't sound right either.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
stocking surprise.
That doesn't sound right either.
Stocking surprise sounds like a cool, it's like
yeah,
a small
bar. I would, you know, look, if there is the fifth guest.
Yes.
If there's the fifth guest, then my wife will be on the show.
Yeah.
If there's not.
That would be a sixth also.
Mm.
No, she'll come on for a bonus episode.
If there's a fifth, there's a sixth.
Yeah, true. Bonus. True.
This must be confusing for people listening.
Yes. To
this. For their first show.
Yeah, for their first show. Yeah. Yeah.
If they actually, I do have one other thing. If there is a guest I would like you to interview, it would be yourself. And it would be...
Yeah, we just did that. The clone.
No, the clone thing. Yeah, no, the clone thing.
That was before the stocking filler.
Speak more to this. It's like, you know, you have been doing this for 2 years as pretty much almost like a part-time job, I would guess, in many ways. Just the hours you put into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Since, you know, 2 years ago, the three of us on this particular podcast, we're in a hotel room, very lubricated and in fun ways.
And then we had some drinks.
Yeah. and it came up with this crazy thing, which you ended up bashing out, and you've devoted a huge part of your life to. And I know, as someone who's known you for many years, this film has been such a passion for you.
Yeah.
And it has been so rewarding to see you devote yourself to a passion as a or sort of vocation, really.
Thank you.
And it's just been wonderful.
Well, thank you.
It's been a privilege to be a part of it.
Oh, it's a hell of an effort. Yeah. I think it's amazing. I think absolutely.
And speaking as a self-centered prick,
even if we're stocking filler, I mean,
I don't think I've
done. As I said on the last time I was on, Luke said Blake would never make it, and I used to say, "No, I give him a chance." He'd go, "No, I'm not."
Time before that, Stu said he's never going to do it, and I said, "No, he will. I will."
Yeah, he says, "You cut him some slack."
Yeah, cut him some slack, Stu. Hang on, are you talking about you remembering yourself, or am I Stu now?
I don't think either of us were.
Okay. Yeah, no. Neither of us. No, you're stupid.
Back in the pieces.
Hang on.
Wait a minute. No, it's been. This has been. Yeah. I actually don't want it to end.
No. Look, speaking as the self-centered prick, I've put probably more energy into this than I think any of my other friends endeavors. To be frankly honest. But you have that ability to get you enlist people and help people with this.
Look, I at least try and feed you. Great. I try and keep you fed. Often plied with booze and comfortable.
It's been wonderful and it's been inspiring and been great.
Can we do bonus features, for example? I mean, we could.
Do we do deleted podcasts?
I'm making
deleted episodes.
I'm making you a promise.
No, I mean bonus features from the disc.
Like, do we do like?
Yeah, so we can go through each minute of that. That'll give us another 20 stocking fillers.
Well, is there an audio commentary?
There is.
We might have to do the movie again.
We'll talk over it.
No, we do 1 minute per time of the audio commentary.
Oh, God. Yeah, we can do that.
We
haven't even begun.
Yeah, we haven't even finished the movie proper.
So, firstly, no. That's not happening. But what I did, I will make a promise, and this is the promise I made to Reed Coleman. Reed and Michael Mann are collaborating on the Heat prequel novel, and the goal is, well, if it's good enough and people like it, and it's got the market, then maybe it's a good script, and maybe it's a novel that is adapted into a script, and then maybe it's a script that's being able to be made into a film, and they bring, you know, some of the original cast back, because it is a both prequel and sequel, so bringing in an awesome prequel cast of, you know, recasting some of those original titles.
Once we see how The Irishman looks,
potentially, you don't know, could happen with some technology, or. You know, my dream is, you know, a John Bernthal as Robert De Niro and Oscar Isaac as a young Al Pacino, and you bring those guys and some other wonderful, you know, up and coming actors, and you go nuts, or even earlier, get younger guys if that's how you want to play it. You know, we saw it, you know. I personally like the recast because I like what you can do with a recast. You know, a la Moonlight, I love that. But I would just say, yeah. If they do a prequel, this show comes back.
What would the title be called? Warm? Semi-hot?
Semi-hot?
Yeah. Come on, I mean, it's got to be temperature related, doesn't it?
More heat?
More less. No, but this, less. Yeah, it has to, you have to warm up to the heat.
I assume the spin-off would be humidity.
Humidity?
Humidity?
Yeah.
Or hot.
Hot's the Spanish remake.
I don't know, because the title is cool? It's really what hard to get the title.
No, it's a sequel and a prequel.
So it'd be cool and hot.
Hot and cool. Hot and cold.
No, but yeah. No, because you're cool before the heat.
Do it like Aliens. So it's eat
The title. Yes. The title's very difficult.
Well, no, I
thought, well, we don't have to
we don't have to figure it out. That is true. Yeah. We don't have to.
Or but if the show if
no,
the,
but we'll get a we'll I, get a whiteboard I, in I here would, and we'll start
I,
knocking
I out would just I would just say if it's this show, it just stays as One Heat Minute and we just tackle the prequel. Like whatever the title is, it's One Heat Minute, blah, and then the episode title.
Heat 2, Climate Control.
Listen, there are no bad ideas in brainstorming. We also don't say no to anyone. But there are going to be some we use, however, and others we don't.
My favorite,
I had to say that was a bad idea.
If we had to set a base, we wouldn't, because we're not that type of people. We're not.
My favorite is your gay porn parody title. What? Meat.
Meat
is good. I do like meat, but
you can imagine this scene.
This scene, indeed.
It's filmed in a cubicle.
So.
Are they talking?
I don't want no regular
different cubicles. Yeah. Is
there, I don't want no regular type sex life. Neither do I.
Brother, you are going down.
I thought I already was.
I'd love to see a dramatically convincing scene between two people in the same cubicle.
Yeah, be tense.
Have you seen that? I can't remember seeing that.
What?
I've seen eight guys in the same cubicle in Raid 2.
Yeah, you had three people in Mission Impossible Fallout.
That's not so much a dialogue exchange. Yeah. More of a,
Sense8 had about 12 people having an orgy in a cubicle.
Again, not so much a dialogue exchange.
More of a fluid exchange.
More of a fluid exchange.
Yeah. It was impeccably shot.
Yeah,
Wachowski's, what do you expect?
Not many cubicle comes to mind.
No,
it's almost like it's an underserved...
You need more cubicle?
Maybe it's not a genre.
So the maybe like phone
booth. I gotta have more cubicle. Like,
yeah, cubicle. You're in there. Although in the phone booth, there was only one person in the phone booth.
Yeah.
There you go. There's an idea for a movie. Set it entirely within a toilet cubicle.
Yeah.
Like, as long as there's contained not too much thriller. Bowel movement, I think it could be a hit.
Define too much.
Any movie.
Well, that's what you do. The guy sits down in the toilet and it's wired to a bomb. I don't know what that was.
I guess we had Lethal Weapon 2.
Yeah, that's true.
But that was not a cubicle.
No, that was a home toilet.
Bathroom.
Just a standard home toilet.
But they got a weird bathroom. The Murtaugh's have a weird bathroom set up anyway.
They have a weird...
The whole family storms in while Dad's...
In the bath, yeah.
In the
bath. Regularly.
To bring him his thing, and they're like stare at his junk.
They threw a face washer on it.
You think that's covering Murtaugh's junk?
At least pitching
but that's it's Daddy Glover. That's the second one they did that.
No,
not the first one. They don't throw anything over.
No, I just rewatched the third one the other day. Yeah, it's the third one they throws the towel over.
Yeah, not in the first one. It's just come one, come all.
Yeah.
Indeed.
I think bathing is a private experience. And
not in the Murtaugh household.
No.
Just in my own.
How did we get here is my question.
Look, you got the Lord of the Tangents here. These two. I was keeping us on the straight and narrow. I'm talking about ketchup bottles and upmarket diners.
Stocking fillers. Easy financing.
Hey.
It's been a blast.
Thank you all. The most creatively rewarding and fruitful experience of my entire life. And all three of you, your time is invaluable. And I just want to say thank you because you've dedicated so much of it to me. And every time that I've asked, you've all been there. And it's been amazing. And even just encouraging texts and support and just actually helping me push this locomotive into motion. It's just been incredible. So I just want to say thank you because I like Vincent Hanna right now, I'm sort of staring off into the mid distance and not knowing what to do because I have slayed my Neil McCauley. I'm here. And I think that's why it's my favorite scene. Cause like now, right now in my life, this might've been my favorite scene. There might've been other scenes in this movie that I can deeply appreciate, but, I have the unbelievably unique experience of watching this movie and hearing countless voices in my head and unpack every single frame of it, and some of those voices, prominent voices, are you three, and I love you all.
And we need to send you to a psycho ward. No?
And, yes, I love you all. And when I do go to the psycho ward, please get Joaquin Phoenix from Inherent Vice to break me out, and occasionally have Owen Wilson in a chant circle that can chant the fuck. thank you so much. And I'll once the next project is decided, folks will hear about it. But I'm going to keep that pretty close to my chest this minute. And I'm sure if it's ready, there'll be a trailer at the end of this series. So
please don't take Babe Pig in the City. I want the
one. No, that's yours. That's all yours. That is yours. I'm going to produce it, but it's all yours, Mr. Right. Buckmaster. That's totally all I ask. That's totally fine.
And you know I'm not joking.
I know. I'm in. I'm
Babe,
all in.
Babe Pig by the minute?
Not bad.
Babe Pig in a blanket? No, sorry. Nah. That's food. All right. So that's it. There's no more One Heat Minute with these three gentlemen. They've been amazing. If you guys listen to the live episode, you might hear them baying for blood in the background and heckling. Bless them.
We will heckle.
Oh, yes. A million percent.
My God, we'll heckle.
It's going to be pretty... We're probably going to be
bloody and brutal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of dirt's going to be thrown.
Yeah.
Thank you. Us.
Be a couple of like all-day refs, like yelling out that long.
But then you abuse the ref.
Yeah.
That's the secret.
Get into the ref. The sporting
experience. Target the ref.
My favourite line to a ref is fire up, touchy, big unit. especially the shorter the touch judge, the better. Thank you, Mr. Luke Buckmaster. Amazing critic for Guardian, Crikey, editor of flicks.com.au. He's amazing. Read his stuff. Find him on Twitter, Mr. Luke Buckmaster. Stu... _ Watchers is Stu Coote, the legend behind Cinephiles and such an amazingly huge part of this show. And finally, at Dark Horizons, darkhorizons.com, one of the OG trailblazer internet sites and the fucking man machine T1000 Garth Franklin, who writes more articles than almost any publication in Australia. I don't care if they got 20 staff, this mofo, he's the one literally outriding them. I love you all. You're all dear to me. And thank you for doing the show. And there'll only be a few more One Heat Minutes left, so for one of the last times, catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.